When does literature happen? This magazine on the table is just, what is this, an object? So someone has to come, the reader, and read a piece and go through the words of a writer. And it's in this movement that literature happens. It's something that happens in the present.
You're listening to Berlin Review. I'm Tobias Haberkorn, and this is a live conversation recorded at the Literaturhaus Berlin last summer. This was the launch of our third reader, and while the magazine has now reached its fifth edition, many parts of the conversation about how to be a writer and a reader in disorienting times are just as alive and urgent today. My colleague and Berlin Review editor Samir Selami spoke with two writers featured in Reader 3. Samantha Schreibling from Argentina is a master of the long and short narrative. Her story collection, Seven Empty Houses, won her a National Book Award in 2022, and we're proud to publish in our Year 3 her story, A Fabulous Animal, that speaks about death, a fateful phone call, and the wish to become a horse. Ricardo Domenech is a writer and critic from Brazil. He's the author of four poetry collections of his own. And in our Reader 3, he took a deep dive into the life and work of the Brazilian novelist Victor Heriger, who died way too young at only 29 in 2018. Together with Samir, both writers, who have been living in Berlin for a number of years, discuss how their writing was shaped by literary magazines, diaspora, and keeping the weird alive in a world that feels like a mix of cheap satire and unending police reports. Here is their conversation.
Samantha, I'm curious. So was there at one point in your life or in your career, was there any moment where literary magazines played a significant role?
So when I was 12, 13, there was a magazine in Argentina that was called El Péndulo. Mm-hmm. That was amazing because it was a very multidisciplinary magazine. So you had fiction, some chronicas, cartoons, illustrators would work there. And for example, all my first encounters with very international science fiction authors, like for example, Ray Bradbury, Ballard, Philip K. Dick, Lovecraft. This was a place where I met them, and I read them for the first time in between also very good Latin American authors, Mario Lebrero, or I don't know, Angelica Gorodischer. They published mostly science fiction and fantastic literature. But also, I think it was very important because in this magazine, it was not only about the authors, but also about the readers. Mm-hmm. So readers would have small columns and, you know, give them opinions about a particular book or criticize something. And also I read for the first time literary interviews. When you as a boy, a girl, think for the first time, oh yes, there is a routine when you write something. Oh yeah, you have to work a lot with a piece of work to really make this work, you know? I think I started to think about that process thanks to this magazine.
Was there a similar, like, initial moment or something else?
I mean, when I started, there were a few magazines already in activity in Brazil. And of course, when you are an unpublished writer, there's always that illusion that when you need to get published because your life is going to change. You think that, like, you're going to walk the streets shining a little bit more than the others. But for me personally, the great experience was actually starting a magazine with other poets my age. Because I always feel that, of course, like, you're always looking up to older writers and you look for a mentor or so and so on. But I always tell younger writers nowadays that I feel that really having a group of writers your age, of your generation, is extremely important. So starting, like, the first magazine that I started in 2007 with three other Brazilian poets, Angélica Freitas, Marília Garcia, and Fabiano Calisto, it was called Modo de Usar e Companhia. It was really important to create somehow this community of writers and to start understanding what are the questions of my generation. Do we want to answer the questions from previous generations, or do we have different questions that we want to answer? So for me, this, like, this creation of this community, and also, like, you know, the idea of, like, being a writer or a reader, I always like to feel that, like, writing is just the most intense form of reading, in a way, that it's such an intense form of reading that you're creating the text that you read. I mean, I know that sounds maybe a bit too metaphorical, but in a way, I like to feel the writer as just a very intense reader. You
know? I always found this a very Latin American topic. Writing is just like a kind of natural extension of intensive reading. Samantha, I want to ask you something that in a preview, this is not our first conversation. We already talked a few years ago about your work and your literary career, if you want. And then they told me, once you arrived in Berlin, you discovered your generation. Your continental. No, I don't say. I won't go there.
Continental.
The other writers of your generation that were writing in Spanish from Latin America, but that you didn't have this access to in the same sense that you had in Berlin. Can you tell us a bit about this? And also maybe if magazines again played a role in that, not just that you got the books, but also maybe magazines.
Well, you know, magazines played an super important role, because I remember in the, for example, in the 70s, we had the military coups in Argentina in the 70s. We have two super important magazines, El Escarabajo de Oro y El Grillo de Papel, who was Silvio Iparraguirre, Liliana Hecker, and Abelardo Castillo were directing these two magazines. And they went from Argentina through all Latin America. So, but the big problem here, even in between the Spanish-speaking world, is like, for example, even in the 80s and in the 90s, if you publish something, a very good book, then the Spanish in Europe will publish you.
Like in Barcelona.
In Barcelona. Yeah. That would take 3 or 4 years. And then if it worked in Spain, then they will put the book in the rest of the small countries in Latin America. So for an Uruguayan to read a Chilean, it could take like 10 years. It was crazy. It was like that.
And then if you don't write Realismo Mágico, it's even worse.
Right? Yes, exactly.
Shall we go down the
road? We don't write those things anymore. But so for answer your question, when I came here in the, it was at the beginning of the, it was 2013, 14, I was suddenly like living like a 30-minute walking from one of the biggest libraries with a Ibero-American, say, you can say it in German.
You say, I think the unofficial name is El Ibero.
Okay.
It's very close.
Like yes, in El Ibero.
Next to the Stavi in Potsdamer Platz.
So here, for the first time, I could find all this book just at hand, and I started to read more Latin American people being here in Berlin.
Ricardo, what about you? How did arriving in Berlin, you arrived quite early, right? You're here
2002.
Yeah.
I mean, I that distance is always good in a way, because there are so many things that you take for granted or that you take as just natural, even in the language, things that it's almost like when you start repeating a word and it starts becoming absurd. When you are in another country surrounded by a language that sounds completely different and also has a different structure in many ways, you start realizing the constructiveness of your own language in a way, and that starts playing more of a role. I feel that I started playing a bit more with sound, because like the sound of Portuguese, of the Brazilian Portuguese, became more clear to me by being here. And there are some things that we can see with a certain distance as well, that when you are enmeshed in the country, at the same time, I don't know, you probably lose certain things. You know, you probably lose a certain context with the zeitgeist of the country in a way. But now it doesn't really matter if you're in a small town in the middle of the country or in Berlin, because through the internet you can still participate in the conversation. So it's still possible to be present even though you're absent in a way.
So you're also publishing your own magazine that has a wonderful name. I'm very jealous of this name, Pecher Boy. Mm-hmm. Pecher Boy is what you in German would call a Seekuh. I think in English there is
manatee.
I don't know if you have a picture of these animals. They are very big. They live in the sea, but they breathe. So they have to get up every 5 or 9 minutes or so to take a breath. And so you can like whale watch them or sea cow watch them, but you only see them coming out. And they are extremely big animals, and they only eat grass. So I was thinking, what is behind your magazine? Is it like, is it a vegan and voracious magazine, or what is behind it?
No, it's not. I don't know. Okay, why? Like, now I have to go into my unconscious to find out why I named the magazine that way. I mean, at the time, I was really interested in this concept of zoopoetics. That's something that is being discussed a lot in Brazil right now, which is like, how can you present the consciousness of another species in human language? And then like, you know, Kafka goes into it, and so on and so forth. All the writers that tried to present the consciousness of another species, and in a country like Brazil, where we have this very strange and schizophrenic even relationship with nature, Brazil always wants to separate very clearly, this is civilization, this is nature, and so on and so forth. Also because they wanted to prove to the Europeans that they are also civilized. They also have stone buildings and stuff like this. And it's a very schizophrenic relationship, I think, that Brazilians have with nature, even though we are surrounded by it. I also feel that it's very different, the relationship that we have with nature, also to here, because every time a German asks me to go take a stroll in nature, even though I've been here for a very long time, I still have that Brazilian programming comes into my mind. It's like, what do you mean? That's dangerous. Like, what do you, like, because here, nature...
I thought you would say there is no nature.
Well, I mean, there is something that you call nature. So completely humanized. Every tree has been millimetrically chosen to be here and here and here and so on and so forth. But the big predators are gone. The worst that can happen to you is meet a wild boar that might, you know, actually cause real damage. But still, it's different from, like, you know, in Brazil, you have to be careful with the spiders, the snakes, and depending on where you are, you still have big predators. So there's this feeling of nature as dangerous. And we're discussing, of course, because of the climate collapse and the Amazon, this has always been very present in Brazil. But I think there's a shift in how we're discussing it now. And I was looking for an animal. I'm going to try to not talk too much. Sorry for the monologue. But I also feel that Brazilian writers, they love, like, there's an obsession with the jaguar. Like, there's always the jaguar because it's this dangerous animal. And everybody wants to be a jaguar. And I prefer the capybaras and the manatees. I think somebody has to be prey. We can't all be predators, you know? I don't mind being a prey. So that's it.
Everybody should read, though, the wonderful story, My Uncle the Jaguar.
That's a really
by
good one, yeah.
Gemaris Rose. I think it's, there must be a German translation.
There's a German translation.
Probably by
Kurt Meyer Classen.
Kurt Meyer Classen, yeah. Exactly.
My Uncle the Jaguar.
My
it's
Uncle
fantastic.
The Jaguar. Animals are a perfect cue to make a transition that is one. Samantha, animals appear a lot in your stories, but in that story, there is a horse. An injured horse, a suffering horse, there is a dead boy, there is two people that once lived in the same, I think it's not a part of Buenos Aires, right? It's a city in the Gran Buenos Aires.
Exactly, yes.
And there is a kind of strange non-communication about this tragic case of the death of that boy. Mm-hmm. And the horse plays a certain role. And I was struck by one sentence. At one point, the I don't think it's the narrator, right? It's just the character. They were talking for some time on the phone. There's a lot of silences and pauses. And then she says, suddenly I knew what this phone call is all about. Mm. Do you sometimes have this feeling when you read your own stuff that you suddenly know what it's all about? Because it's hard to tell what your stories are about.
About?
No, it's easy
it's
to
good
tell.
Thing or a bad thing?
No, it's a good thing, of course. No, it's a good thing.
Rebecca Solnit says that a good book is a hurt bumping in someone else's chest. And I love this saying, and I think it's about that. So, like, for example, I mean, the title of the new book is The Good Evil, mm-hmm. Buen Mal. So it's this strange relationship between the good and the evil, and what is good and what is evil. But it's not something general. It's a very, very, very specific thing that I want to share.
I really like that title. It triggers some ideas about morality and so on. And I think the dedication or the quote, the motto, I don't know how to say that in slogan in English, of your book is Lo raro es más cierto, no? The
yes.
rare, the weird,
yes.
I don't know how to translate this perfectly, is more certain. Did you say that?
I think so, yes, could be, yes. It's from Silvino Campo.
Yeah,
yes.
And I was thinking about this a lot. Like, as we already mentioned, you're a writer who was born in Argentina, we have another writer who was born in Brazil, and I mean, we all know what's happening. We can assist the horror picture show that happens with Milei and now Trump, of course. Yesterday, Bolsonaro was leading a protest march against to give him amnesty. Amnesty, right?
Amnesty, yeah. for the coup, yeah.
He tried to speak English. It didn't work well. But still, yeah, these things are happening. So do you feel that, like, how you work with the weird is getting even more difficult? Mm-hmm. Is it enough to just... I mean, do you know what I mean a bit? Maybe I can put it in another way. I was thinking a lot about satire these days. Like, is satire? You're not satiric writers, but is satire still possible when everything is like a real satire in real life in this velocity? So I was thinking about the status of the weirdness in literature, maybe in general.
Yeah, satire has a lot to do with Milei. Yeah. So yeah. I understand that word there. I don't know. I think. To write is to do the exercise, the actual physical exercise of testing yourself against the things that could hurt you. And we write something, but then the reader came and read these stories in its own context and something new happened. Mm. And it's very amazing when that happens. So for example, in my book, I heard and I read people talking about the last short story as the first Mileísta story in Argentina. And of course, when I wrote that story, I was not thinking about Milei at all. Mm. But it's the story about...
Thank God. Thank God you were not.
I mean, it's a story about someone who is having a good life and everything is well organized and suddenly someone entered in her house and basically destroyed everything with his own ideas of what is good, what is bad, what is moral and what is not. And a lot of people under these days' context in Argentina are doing that reading in this story. So, yes, that's how fiction works.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that when you look at politics in Brazil right now or in Argentina, that there's something that could seem satirical, but I can't look at it as... I'm looking at it as horror. I think it's a different genre for me. I'm trying to approach the whole thing now like from the concept of hauntology. I think that... like Mark Fisher wrote a lot about that in his book Ghosts of My Life, but he takes it from Derrida, the idea of like hauntology, that like, you know, a past that is dead but continues to haunt the present. And I think in a way what we are seeing in Brazil has a lot to do with the ghosts of the dictatorship, and then we're back again to Edinger's novel, which is so much about these ghosts from the dictatorship, which we thought were dead. We thought that this is the past, this context is closed, but it's not. Just as much as we're seeing here in Europe, that we thought that the ghosts of the Second World War were also these are all dead now, this context is gone, but there's a haunting, there are ghosts that continue to haunt the political present. I mean, I always liked that image from horror movies of the house that is haunted because it was built on top of an Indian cemetery, which is an image of colonial guilt, I think. It's no wonder that it comes out of American movies. Mm. But I think any country in the Americas this is a very apt image for any country in the Americas. It's a house that is haunted because it was built on top of an Indian cemetery. And then when you talk about Brazil, there's not just the indigenous, but you also, then all the dead of like 300 years of slavery, and then the dead from the dictatorship. And Brazil has this tendency of like, no, we look forward, we're looking to the future, we don't have to look to the past. There's always this obsession of like, no, like this is a chapter, this is closed. But somehow we are accumulating these ghosts that at some point have to explode in violence. And of course, I mean, there's so many things which are ridiculous about Milei and about Bolsonaro. It's I don't even like to talk to him because it seems to me like such a small man, really tiny, so tiny. But I think the danger there is not so much them, but the forces that find them useful.
Yeah.
And that is what's so dangerous.
Okay, I think we could also take two questions and then...
Question in the back here? It's fine? Okay.
Of course.
Hi guys, thanks for the amazing event. I want to come back to, I think, the first point that Samir said about the fact that you are both diasporic writers. How do you think the fact of being part of a diaspora impact your writing after coming to Berlin? Sometimes the fact that you're very far away from your country makes you feel paradoxically even more belonging to the country. So I wanted to hear more about it from you. Thanks.
I have to be honest, I never use that word, diasporic, to refer to myself or to my writing. I understand the use that was made here, and I respect it, but I feel that, like, coming from Brazil, knowing that that word is usually used in the context of the Afro-Brazilian literature, me choosing to be in Berlin just doesn't feel like I deserve to use that word. Now, like being, so many Brazilian writers, it was very typical maybe 50 years ago for Brazilian writers to be diplomats. A lot of them were diplomats. So a lot of Brazilian literature was actually produced abroad. Clarice Lispector, João Guimarães Rosa, João Cabral de Melo Neto, all these writers produced a lot of their books abroad. I feel sometimes that, like I said, being here in a way makes me look at things that maybe I wouldn't see otherwise, so I find it positive. But I'm always conscious of this distance always cutting certain connections with the country as well. So every time I go back, I feel that I need sort of to catch up with certain things. But I mean, I don't mind the word exile, you know, in a way. But again, also then that word again is feels really heavy because I think of the writers who had to leave Brazil during the military dictatorship. I'm here because it's my choice.
Yeah, I agree with what you said. But also when you said I'm here because it's my choice, I thought, was it really our choice? Because when they ask me, why did you stay in Berlin? I always say, oh, you know, the canals, the parks, so many languages, the different tribes. I have this amazing library. But deep down, I mean, I stayed here because in Berlin, working half of the week, I mean, it took me half of the week of working to buy the money that I need to buy my free time to write. So in Argentina, I had to work from Monday to Saturday, and then I wrote in Sunday, and here I have to work from Monday to Wednesday, and I have 4 days for writing. And that was the real reason. And that's something that, I mean, most of the writers who are very successful outside Latin America, and for Latin American authors, that means to earn money in euros or in dollars. I mean, I'm sorry that I'm talking about money, but money is the thing that we need to buy our free time to write, and we want to write, so this is important. Mm-hmm. And most of these writers are living abroad. Mm-hmm. So then the diaspora, I know, is not the same than the political diaspora, but it is a kind of, it was not forced. I'm super happy here, but there is something there that is not fair. I compare with many friends that are as talented as me, and they can't write in Argentina because they are just having three works, just only for paying the rent, you know? And there's so many talented people that are just stuck there.
I left Brazil in 2002. It was a completely different political context where there was, I mean, I didn't feel there as safe as a homosexual. So for me, in that sense, I could also say, well, in a way, you know, I left because here, you know, it seemed like the whole city was just ruled by homosexuals. from the mayor to the director of the clubs, I was like, well, great, we're finally the majority. That's how I felt when I arrived. So there was also the sense of like being definitely a much safer space. And in that sense, like, I don't want to take that lightly. I just want to be careful also. You know, I just want to have some sort of, like, how can I put it, just parameter, no? In the sense of, like, of how much in danger I was, or
in that moment, which I think it could be really dangerous. But yeah, definitely, I mean, you know, I managed somehow, one way or another, to live in Berlin from writing and and reviewing and translating, and it would be impossible in Brazil.
Yeah, I have friends Argentina who, the same.
And like during, I mean, and I'm not playing the hero here, but like during the COVID, I literally had to help some friends who are writers, amazing writers, pay the electricity bill. You know, because they just everything stopped and so on. And so in that sense, like Berlin is really incredible. And I don't think this would be possible in other European capitals either.
Let's maybe take the last. There's one more question, right?
Hi, I also have a similar question. I met a Swedish poet a few months ago, and he was living in Paris for a long time and moved back to Sweden, and I asked him why. And he said he was losing his prepositions. And I was also thinking, do you have any similar experience? What are you losing in Portuguese or Spanish?
My commas here? Went crazy around 2007. 2007, 2008, my commas really went crazy because the comma in German is so, it's just different from the comma in Portuguese. So I can give you that. My commas really, I really have to watch.
Thank God
my
you're
commas are wild.
Thank God you're a poet. I mean, who needs commas anyway?
I use punctuation in my poetry. You want to answer this?
Yeah. Well, I'm still writing in Spanish. I can't write in English. I can't do German. So I'm still working on my realm. But I'm living mostly in a Spanish speaking bubble, and this Spanish speaking bubble is not only from Spain, but here I'm surrounded by all the different kind of Spanish that we have around the world. You know, the Spanish people and the Chilean and the Mexican and the Cuban and the Venezuelan. It's strange because they have amazing words to name things that I can't name with my own language. So I take these words. Why not? They are amazing. But then my Spanish is not so, you know, so porteño, as we say to the people who write around in the city of Buenos Aires, as it used to be. And I still consider myself an Argentinian writer. I mean, I'm here in Berlin, but the moment I put my fingers in the keyboard, I'm back in Argentina and I write about Argentina. But then the Argentinians read me and then they are like, what is this word, you know? Like, so it's very hard because it's my very particular Spanish is my tool. And at the same time, I don't want to eliminate these words because it would be unnatural to start to work in a language that is not really my language. I want to do the more natural thing to do. But at the same time, also, I don't want to distract the reader. I don't want the readers to stop and go to the dictionary and come back. You know, I'm writing with fiction. I'm a short story writer. I want the reader there, the 20 minutes, you know, like reading. So I'm always like paying so much attention of all the words that I'm using, no, and also kind of fighting what is more important to do, to have a natural Spanish that is only mine, or to just, I don't know, force something that is not mine. So it's that's put, as you said, Ricardo, it puts even more attention in my own sounds and in my own words and how an Argentinian reader would read me. Yeah.
I'm just going to say that I only write in English if it's for a performance piece, when I'm collaborating with like a German sound artist and he needs to understand. I mean, I'm a writer, I really like to be understood. When it, like, I want the text to be understood, you know? And I only write in German if they pay very well. But I have a difference to Samantha. I really love sending the readers to the dictionary and giving them a lot of work. I don't mind that. Forcing them to read a few times, it's okay. But it's poetry and fiction is different, so.
Okay, I think that's a good way to start to end this panel. I did not exhaust my list of questions, but I learned from Ricardo that we should always stop when it's going well. So I would invite you now.
Anything in life. To relationships, jobs, interviews.
That was Samir Salami in conversation with Samantha Schweblin and Ricardo Dominic. You can find both their texts in Berlin Review Reader 3 and at blnreview.de. If you like this conversation and you'd like to support our work, the best way to do so is by subscribing. Subscriptions start at just 5 euros a month at blnreview.de/subscribe. Our audio producer is Caitlin Roberts. My name is Tobias Harlequin, editor of Berlin Review. Thanks for listening.